Please, in your Bibles, turn to Judges chapter 14. And if you would stand and join me in the reading of the Word. Judges chapter 14. Samson went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Then he came up and told his father and mother, "I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." But his father and mother said to him, "Is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people that you must go and take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes." His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. Then Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came toward him roaring. Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and although he had nothing in his hand, he tore the lion in pieces, as one tears a young goat. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes. After some days, he returned to take her, and he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion, and honey. He scraped it out into his hands and went on, eating as he went. And he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they ate. But he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey from the carcass of the lion. His father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast there, for so the young men used to do. As soon as the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, "Let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. But if you cannot tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes." And they said to him, "Put your riddle that we may hear it." And he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet." In 3 days they could not solve the riddle. On the fourth day they said to Samson's wife, "Entice your husband to tell us what the riddle is, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us here to impoverish us?" And Samson's wife wept over him and said, "You only hate me. You do not love me. You have put a riddle to my people and have not told me what it is." He said to her, "Behold, I have not told my father nor my mother, and shall I tell you?" She wept before him the 7 days that the feast lasted, and on the seventh day he told her because she pressed him hard. Then she told the riddle to her people, and the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, "What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" And he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle." And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town and took their spoil and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house, and Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. You may be seated. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for how you have preserved it through the centuries. We thank you how you have given us your spirit that we might understand the things that are written. We thank you that you have given us your spirit that these words might change our lives as well. And that is our goal this morning, Father, not just to be hearers of the word, but to be doers also. And so, Father, as we look into your word this morning, prepare our hearts to hear what it is that you want us to hear, and prepare our lives, our wills to be changed, to become more conformed to the image of Christ because of the time that we've spent together here in your word, and in worshiping you this morning. We ask this in Jesus' name. I remember as a child, you'd hear the the stories in the Old Testament. The stories about the burning bush and, you know, Moses' encounter with that, and the parting of the Red Sea, the plagues that that Moses or that God brought against the Egyptians through Moses, the story of Gideon and the fleece, and the story of David and Goliath, and you know, I think as a child, we don't always see the full picture or the impact, but I think it can give us a sense of wonder of who God is and how God works in and through the people and the situations that He chooses to. And the story of Samson is another one of those stories that I remember hearing as a child and thinking it was kind of a fun story, but it obviously has a tragic end to it, or it appears to have what we would consider a tragic end to it. And yet there were lots of things in that story that as I grew older and would read the story in the scriptures, there's lots of things in there that I don't necessarily understand. And so as we go through this account of Samson in the book of Judges, and we need to put it in the context in which it lies. And that is precisely in the book of Judges. And what have we said about the book of Judges? What is the book of Judges? It's a series of stories or accounts of how God demonstrates His mercy toward His people. In that they demonstrate unfaithfulness to Him, and they turn toward the idols and the gods of the people of the nation that they're inhabiting, and God then turns them over to be oppressed by one people or another, and as a result of the oppression, the people cry out to God, and God hears, and God responds and sends a deliverer, and those deliverers are called the judges. And so there's a series of those in this book. And Samson is the last in that series. But there's a lot of things about this account of Samson that are particularly unique in these accounts. For one, we're told a lot about his birth and the circumstances around his birth, and the fact that, and we looked at that last time we were here, how his mother was barren and had no children and prayed that she might have a child. And an angel, or probably more likely a theophany or a Christophany. It was actually God himself who appeared to her and told her that she would have a child. And if you remember in verse 25 of chapter 13, well, I guess it would be verses 24 and 25. And the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the young man grew, and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir in him. And so we see that God is at work providing for something for the nation of Israel. But if we look all the way back, in verse, I believe it's in verse 3. Verse 5, where it talks about where the angel or where God is instructing the woman, who, as you recall, we were never told her name. It was simply the wife of Manoah. But in verse 5 it says, Behold, this is in chapter 13, for behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to save Israel from the hands of the Philistines. And there were some strategic things in that particular verse that we need to remember as we look at and further develop the context of Samson. First of all, he was a Nazarite from birth, which was really rather unusual. If you recall, most people simply took up a Nazarite vow as an adult, and it was only for a period of time. But he was appointed, or he was anointed as a Nazarite from his birth, which included several things. And one of them that is mentioned here is that no razor should touch his head, so his hair was not to be cut. One of the other things was he wasn't to touch dead bodies, and he wasn't to drink strong drink. But it also makes a statement here. It says, he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Samson is different in his role as a judge than the other judges that we've seen, because it simply says he will begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Whereas if you remember all the other judges, the victory was finalized and there was relief from the oppression. But not in Samson's case. This is only the beginning. And if you know your stories in the Old Testament, there was an altercation between David and the Philistines. Remember the big guy Goliath? He was with the Philistines. And so even up to that point, Israel is still being oppressed by the Philistines. So there is an extended period of time here that the Philistines are oppressing the nation of Israel. And so this is just the beginning, which is a difference than most or than all the other judges. The fact that he was chosen from birth is a difference. None of the other judges were chosen from birth that we are told. They were chosen at a later time in life and for a specific purpose, and they reigned as a judge, whereas Samson is chosen, and we talked about a little bit about him being a Nazarite and the things that involved. We also see that, and it's stated of him several times, and we see a glimpse of it in verse 25 of chapter 3, and it says, the Spirit of the Lord began to stir in him. But there's, in chapter 14, there's at least two instances where we see the phrase, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. And there's other references to that as well in chapters 15 and 16. So we see that there's a little difference in the way Samson's relief from the Philistines is demonstrated and expressed, and that there are sudden bursts of the Spirit in him. And for most of the other judges, we see that it was a joint effort of the judge and the people of Israel. Well, you'll see that as we go through the story of Samson, it's just Samson. He's kind of out there all by himself doing these things. And in fact, there's one spot in which he actually is betrayed by his own people. So as the book of Judges is coming to a close here, and we see the story of Samson, and we notice that there's significant differences between Samson and the other judges, the logical thing to do is to ask the question, why? You know, why is Samson different than the other judges? And the fact that Samson gets four whole chapters of the book of Judges devoted to his life and his activities. Is that coincidental? You think that's just the way it happened? Just, you know, God happened to inspire this guy to write the book of Judges, and that's just the way it happened? I don't think so. I personally think that God is very particular in the way he communicates and what he wants us to understand. I think there's some reasons why. Number one, Samson is at the end. It's kind of the climax of this. There's reasons why the way Samson's judgeship is different. And there's reasons that God is trying to communicate to us that are much deeper than just a child's story here. So as we go through this passage, we'll kind of begin to unfold some of those things and what some of those things are. So we're going to start back at the beginning. We're not going to get through the whole story of Samson this morning. It's probably going to take us the rest of the year to do that, since I'm probably only going to fill the pulpit a couple more times this year. But that's okay. You remember, I'm speaking to those of us that are old enough to remember when we used to watch television, and you always hated it when the last frame of the television show said, "To be continued." It's like, ugh. But back in those days, they actually would give you glimpses of what the next episode would be. So, you know, it's kind of an enticing thing to make sure that you were there in front of the television the next week to watch it. And that was back when we didn't have recording devices, and you could just watch your TV shows whenever you wanted to. If you weren't in front of the TV at the specific time, you didn't see the show. And so they controlled our lives a little more back then with the television. But anyway, so the story of Samson is kind of like that for the next few messages that I bring. So it's to be continued. But so as we look through chapter 14, we're at the stage in Samson's life where he's a young man. He's not married yet. We don't really know exactly how old he was. Probably his younger 20s at this point. One of the things that we also need to think about is, do you remember the story where the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant, and they took the Ark of the Covenant and they took it to the temple of their god Dagon? And when they came in the morning, the statue of Dagon was fallen down and in a position of worshiping the ark. And so the Philistines set their god back up. And the next day they came, and sure enough, Dagon was flat on his face again. But this time his head had been cut off and his hands had been cut off. And at that point, the Philistines decided that this was not a good thing to have in the temple of their god. And so they decided to give the Ark of the Covenant back. Those are the kinds of things that are contemporary to Samson's story. Okay, those are the things that were going on at the same time Samson was living and Samson was doing the things that he was doing. And so there was a great deal of animosity between the Philistines and the Israelites. But right here at the beginning is probably just prior to when those animosities were heating up, because it says Samson went down to Timnah, which my understanding is about an hour's walk from where he lived. And at Timnah, he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. And so what this tells us is that in the land of that was supposed to be Israel's, they were supposed to have conquered that land, and they were supposed to have expunged all of the people that lived there. They were supposed to have annihilated them, which they obviously didn't, because the Philistines are obviously living there, because here's this young woman that's living in a town that's an hour away from where he lived. And he came up and told his father and mother, "I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as a wife." The typical custom in those days was for the parents to arrange a marriage. And it wasn't necessarily always that the man didn't have a choice. Sometimes he did. He would see someone that he wanted to be his wife, and he would ask his parents to make the arrangements for her to be his wife. And so this is not necessarily an unusual situation for Samson to see someone that I think this woman would make me a great wife. And so he goes and he tells his parents. Well, now we see there's a problem. But his father and mother said to him, "Is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all of the people that you must go and take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" And the derogatoriness of their statement, the uncircumcised Philistines, come on, these are just nasty people. We don't want to intermarry with them. Not only that, there was a command given to them back in Exodus that they were not to intermarry with the people of the land that they were to conquer. And so we see Samson, who is supposed to be a Nazarite here from birth. He has certain things that he's supposed to avoid doing. And yet it's as though he doesn't know the law, or he doesn't care what the law states, because he's decided. Because what does he say? He says, "But Samson said to his father, 'Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes.'" I don't care what the law says. I don't care what God says. This is what I want. Get it for me. And so we begin to see a little bit of who Samson is here. And, you know, is it because of his privileged state before God, and that he was, you know, ordained from his birth to be a Nazarite? You know, if we look back and remember the high priest Eli and his two sons and the wickedness of those sons, and you wonder if because they were born into a family of position, they take for granted who they are, and they think that they can have whatever they want. And I wonder if the same thing's not true about Samson here. It's like, I'm a privileged person. I can do whatever I want. You know, I'm a Nazarite, but I'm blessed by God. I can do what I want. And so let's keep that in mind as we go through this and we think about who Samson is and why he does some of the things he does. And then verse 4 comes. And this is one of those verses that I referred to earlier that I think it's hard to understand. It's one of those things that when you read it the first time, if you don't think about it, you just kind of gloss over it. But if you go back to it and you read it again, you go, okay, wait a minute. It says, "His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel." What is that verse saying? It's saying that his father and his mother did not understand what God was doing. So are we to understand that God was prompting Samson to do what he had commanded him not to do in order to accomplish his purposes? Is God the originator of sin? Is that what this verse is telling us? I mean, at first glance, it almost looks like that, doesn't it? But we know that God does not sin, and God cannot be tempted to sin. And so there has to be some other explanation of this. And so, you know, I begin to think about other scriptures and where, you know, where can we find some answers to these things, to this question? And I thought of Joseph and his brothers. In Genesis chapter 50:20, it says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." If we think about that, Joseph's brothers intended evil on Joseph. What they did was to cause Joseph distress. It was evil. It was wrong for what they did. And yet it tells us here that God had a purpose in what they were doing. And so God was using what they were doing to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. Does that say that he couldn't have accomplished it in a different way? God is God. God can do what he chooses to do. But yet in this situation, he chooses to use the sin of men to accomplish his purposes. How about Exodus chapter 7? In verse 3 it says, "But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt." If you remember the story of Moses coming and asking the Pharaoh to let his people go, and what does the Pharaoh do? First, he denies, he refuses to let him go, and then God begins to show him the signs through the plagues. But each time, God hardens Pharaoh's heart so that he refuses to let the people go until the final plague. And so, here again, you know, is God prompting Pharaoh to be disobedient to God? Is God the person that originates what's evil there? Think about David and Bathsheba. And maybe you're wondering, well, what's that got to do with anything? Who was David's son that became king after him? It was Solomon. And Solomon was in the line that would someday be that of Christ. And so Christ, I mean, being in the lineage of David, was also in the lineage of Solomon. But whose son was Solomon? He was Bathsheba's son. So without the situation in which David committed adultery with Bathsheba, would Solomon have ever been born? And would that have interrupted the line of Christ? And why would God have that kind of a situation even in the line of Christ? Am I creating more questions in your mind than I'm creating answers? Well, welcome to my dilemma. Can I have everybody turn to Acts chapter 2? And I'm going to read verses 22 through 24. Acts chapter 2. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed him by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it. Even in the final act of God's redemption, he is using sinful men to accomplish his purposes. I'm not sure I can give you an answer that you can catalog and understand this completely. But what I want us to think about is the fact that, number one, God is sovereign. It doesn't matter what sin we commit or what sin anyone else commits, God will accomplish his purpose. And we see that in the redemptive work of Christ. The second thing is that we can draw comfort from the fact that even though all around us people are sinning and are disobedient to God, but yet those very acts could be the things that God is using to demonstrate his grace in our life by making us more conformed to the image of Christ. And the final thing is, as we look at our own lives, as we look at, you know, at who we are, and we think about the things that we have done wrong, the evil that we have perpetrated, the sins that we have committed, and we wonder, how can God put up with that? And yet, we have a God who can turn those things into something that glorifies him. Now, does that mean, you know, like the Apostle Paul asked, should we sin all the more that grace may abound? That God could turn our sin into something that he can use? No, we don't understand grace if we have that attitude. But the comfort is that even though in our weak and depraved nature, when we're overcome by passions of lust and we fall to sin, God can make something out of that. And only because He's God. And so we see, even here in Samson's life, even though Samson is willfully disobedient to God, in that he wants to marry a Philistine, God is going to use that. In fact, had planned on using that from the very beginning. So in verse 5, then Samson went down with his father and mother in Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah. There's a little clue in that verse, maybe. As a Nazarite, he wasn't supposed to even eat fruit from the vine. And why does the author mention that he was at the vineyard? It doesn't say specifically what he was doing there, but there might be a hint that he was eating from the vine, maybe some grapes or something of that effect. We're not exactly told there, which would be in violation of his Nazarite vow. But we're going to go on. And behold, a young lion came toward him roaring. Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and although he had nothing in his hands, he tore the lion in pieces as one tears a young goat. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes. So here we see a situation where, and you know, it almost seems like it's like, okay, what's the point? Why are you telling us this? You know, why is Samson experiencing this even? And I think one of the things that God is doing is he's putting Samson in a situation where he can demonstrate to Samson what he's going to do when it says, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. There is a certain superhuman power that enables Samson to do things that normal people wouldn't be able to do. And so, you know, you ask the question. Here's a man who is in the midst of doing something that is completely disobedient to what God has commanded, although within God's purposes. And God is demonstrating His power through this man. And so, I think what we see here is a paradox. It's a contradiction. You know, doesn't God just use people who are willing servants, who are obedient to Him, who do what He commands? I see at least one head shaking out there. If He did, He wouldn't use any of us, would He? Because we all know that, you know, on a daily basis, we can, you know, I can stand up here and hopefully in some degree in the power of the Spirit teach you the Word. And I can walk out of here and be consumed by a passion or a lust and fall from grace in a matter of seconds. And we experience that kind of thing on a daily basis, don't we? And I think that's one of the things that God wants to demonstrate through Samson. It's not about Samson. It's not about us. It's not about our weakness. It's not about our sin. It's about what God is accomplishing through him. And so he kills this lion. And some think that the fact that he doesn't tell his mother and father about this is because Nazarites aren't supposed to touch dead animals. I'm not sure I agree with that, because it wasn't dead until he killed it. And so, you know, was it, you know, technically, was he touching a dead animal? I don't know. But obviously, his parents were not with him when this happened. And so they didn't see the demonstration of God's power. But he went on down, and sure enough, this is the woman for him. So after a few days, verse 8, he returned to take her. And it was the custom then at that time is that they would make arrangements for the marriage. The bride or the groom would go away, and then at some point he would come back to take her to be his wife. And so he was going back to get her to be his wife. And I think as he's going down there, he happened to remember, oh yeah, I killed that lion. I'm going to go take a look at that. So he turns aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion and honey. From what I understand, this is a very, very unusual situation because bees do not like dead things. And so I read two explanations for this. One is that because of the arid climate there, the heat and the arid climate, that the carcass could have dried out so rapidly, and apparently there are examples of this over in that part of the world, Arabia and so forth, that the carcass actually dried out and mummified before it putrefied. And so there was it was like a hollow log, and it made a perfect place for bees to dwell. The other explanation was that there was enough period of time so that the bones actually dried out and there was nothing dead smelling or dead associated with it, and the bees went ahead and took up residence there. Either way, I think, you know, in some senses, I think maybe there is something supernatural going on here. I'm not going to press that issue, but I think maybe God is doing this on purpose. And so what do we see Samson do? You know, I don't know about you and I, but if I saw bees in the carcass of a dead lion, I don't think I'd stick my hand in there and scoop out the honey. I just, number one, I don't want to get stung by the bees. Number two, that just doesn't sound very appetizing to me. But that's what Samson did. And by doing that, what has he just now done? He's violated his Nazirite vow. He's not supposed to eat anything unclean, which means anything that's touched a dead body. And now he's violated his Nazirite vow. So he scraped it into his hands and he went on and he was eating it. And then he had the audacity to give some to his father and mother and not tell them where he had gotten it. You know, not only was he being disobedient to God, but he was also drawing in his parents in their disobedience. And you know, as we go along, we find out that Samson keeps, you know, he keeps things from his parents. He keeps a lot of secrets. So then we go on, and his father went down to the woman, and this is going to be basically the consummation of the marriage. And Samson prepared a feast there, so the young men used to do. My understanding is that word feast actually means place of drinking. And so if he wasn't eating the grapes from the vineyard, he probably was drinking at the feast. And so once again, he's violated his Nazirite vow. And apparently in those days, it was the custom for the man to host a feast and have the families come together and party for 7 days before the consummation of the marriage. And when they saw him, they brought him 30 companions. I guess he didn't have his own companions. He didn't have any friends or something of that nature. So they provided him with some companions to celebrate with him. And then he thought, well, let's have some fun. And he said to them, let me put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. 30 linen garments, those are actually the undergarments. And the 30 changes of clothes would be the outer garments that were, and presumably they're, you know, like their Sunday best stuff. So we're talking about a full set of clothing here, which would have been fairly expensive. But if you cannot tell me it, tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. And they said to him, put your riddle that we may hear it. So they accepted his challenge. They were okay with the challenge of trying to figure out the riddle. And I think one of the things they didn't do when they accepted the challenge was to count the cost of what the challenge would be. And so he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. What is Samson doing here? He killed a lion with his bare hands. Somehow, bees built a hive in there and made honey or collected honey. He's eaten the honey. He's violated his Nazirite vow, and he's making a riddle out of it. I think what Samson is doing here is he's making light of his Nazirite vow. It doesn't mean anything to him. He's using it as a riddle, as a joke with these Philistines who obviously know nothing about Nazirite vows. And in 3 days, they could not solve the riddle. I don't know why they would be able to solve the riddle. I mean, if you hadn't seen the carcass, the lion carcass with the beehive in it, you wouldn't be able to answer the riddle. Verse 15, it says, on the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, and my understanding is some manuscripts actually have the word seventh there rather than fourth. So there's some confusion as to exactly what the sequence of events here is. If it's the fourth day, that makes sense because after the third day. But it's like, why would they just give up on the third day? But and why would you wait till the seventh day to exercise a desperate move to get the riddle answered? But either way, they go to where the weakest link, I guess you might call it, and they tell his wife to entice your husband to tell us what the riddle is, and then they threaten her, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire. And then they say, have you invited us here to impoverish us? And that's why I made the statement earlier. I don't think they counted the cost. Chances are they didn't have a lot of extra changes of clothing. And to give one away was not something that that they necessarily wanted to do, because they didn't have that kind of those kinds of resources. And so that's why they say, you know, what's going on here? Are you trying to make us destitute with this silly riddle? When in fact, they're the ones that agreed to go ahead and accept the challenge. And so Samson's wife wept over him and said, you only hate me and do not love me. You have put a riddle to my people, and you have not told me what it is. And he said to her, behold, I have not told my father and mother, and I shall tell you. In other words, it has nothing to do with love. It's not a matter of whether I love you or not. It's whether I tell this riddle to you or not. I just, you know, you don't need to know. But she kept after him. She wept before him the 7 days that their feast lasted. And on the seventh day, he told her, because she pressed him hard. You need to remember this verse, because this obviously is a very pronounced weakness of Samson, and that is women can convince him to tell secrets that ought not be told. And this is just the beginning. So then she told the riddle to her people, and the men of the city said to him, on the seventh day before the sun went down. In other words, when the sun goes down, that's the end of the day. That's the end of the seventh day. That was supposed to be when he was going to go after that. When the sun went down, he would go in and consummate the marriage at that point. But what happens is they come and they go, here's the answer to your riddle. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? And I don't know if they weren't smart enough to disguise the words that he had told to his wife, who had then related them to him, but he knew immediately that they hadn't figured it out on their own. And he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. In other words, you didn't play fair here. But he goes, okay, you told me the riddle, so I'll pay up. So what does he do? And this is another paradox here, because it says, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town and took their spoil and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle. He went and murdered 30 people, took their clothes and gave them to these guys. And he did it in the power of the Spirit of God. We have a paradox here. This seems to be very contradictory, doesn't it? Why would God do this? Well, I mean, we obviously have to go back to verse 4. He was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. The relationship between Israel and the Philistines was too symbiotic. They were too comfortable with one another. And so God was working to create animosity there so that he could begin
to motivate the children of Israel to drive the Philistines out. But does that mean then that God was the originator of sin because the Spirit of God prompted Samson to go down and to murder these 30 men? And then it says, in hot anger, he went back to his father's house. And there's, because of the verse division there, it makes it sound like he was mad about the whole situations with the garment. But I think the situation, if we read verse 20 then, and it says, Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. What we see is that, and we'll read further on in chapter 15 when we get to there, is that he wasn't mad at the 30 guys. I mean, he was irritated with them, but he had paid his debt to them, if you would. But he was really hot with his wife. And it was like, man, I don't want to be around you. I can't trust you. And so he left. And so the woman's father, the girl's father, went, oh, wow, this has gone from bad to worse. We can't have this. So he made an arrangement for the best man to marry his daughter. And apparently they consummated the marriage and they would now live happily ever after. No, they wouldn't, but we'll get to that at some other time. But so here we see Samson, and we put him in the context of the book of Judges, where, you know, we see God in a cycle of his people being unfaithful, God providing redemption and restoration. And so what is, you know, how do we see Samson here? He's chosen by God. He has a special anointing in that he's able to do some pretty spectacular things. He killed a lion with his bare hands. He killed 30 men. And we'll go on to see that he does some other things. And yet, he's unfaithful to his Nazarite vow. He's disobedient to God. What I think God is doing with this passage is, one, he's giving Israel a picture of what they look like. This is what you guys are like. I have chosen you to be my people. I have provided for you through miraculous wonders, the parting of the Red Sea, the wanderings in the wilderness where I provided food for you every single day. The cloud by night, or the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night to lead them. Water coming from the rock. Signs and wonders, one right after another. And yet, what did the people of Israel do? And even when they came into the land, the fall of Jericho, just the ability to defeat the people in the land. And yet, what do the people do? They're unfaithful. They're chosen by God to be special, shown special privileges, and yet they follow after other gods. But there's a reason, too, that God has preserved His Scriptures through the centuries. This not only is a picture of Israel, but remember last time I said, you know, in many respects, we're Nazarites. We're called to be Nazarites. Not in the sense that, you know, we're not supposed to touch dead bodies. We're not supposed to cut our hair. We're not supposed to drink strong drink. But we are set apart unto God to do certain things, to be a certain way, to deny ourselves certain things if it causes others to stumble. We, in a sense, are Nazarites, and yet, even though God has demonstrated His power in and through us by just by saving us and regenerating us, what do we do day after day? The same kind of thing Samson does. He becomes enslaved to his own passions and creates problems for himself You know, you don't go back and check the carcass. You don't find the honey. You don't have a riddle. You don't have to go kill 30 guys to pay your debt. He's rash. And maybe part of it is his youth, but nevertheless, he's obviously not committed to his Nazarite vow. And so my challenge to us today from all of this is not to be too hard on Samson. And there's more to come. It gets better. And if you want to read ahead, you know, we're not in the TV mode where you have to be here the next time I preach to know what goes on. You can actually read for yourself what's to be continued. But my challenge today is, how can we, in the power of the Spirit that God has given us, that has anointed us, how can we be different today and tomorrow than we were yesterday? What is it that we need to do for God to demonstrate His grace and mercy through us to the world that waits out there? We're going to sin. But we have that comfort that God can change that, and that God has forgiven us of that, and that God can use that for His good and His glory. But we also have the comfort that we have the Holy Spirit living in and through us. And if we can recommit ourselves moment by moment to living by the Spirit. And what about being in the Word and making sure that the Word is a part of our lives every single day? Being in the Word and feeding upon that, so that God can change us and make us different people, so that we can become more conformed to the image of Christ, that we would not be what the children of Israel were, what Samson was, in a cycle where we're always having to call upon God to deliver us, and yet what great comfort there is in that. It doesn't matter how many times we fall down. It doesn't matter how many times we fail. It doesn't matter if our willingness is to get back up and know that God has forgiven us, and to seek that forgiveness and to seek our Father's face. He will have mercy on us. He will demonstrate His grace in us. And that's the hope that I think we take away from the book of Judges as a whole, and especially here today, the story of Samson. So, God bless.